On this week's 51%, a pioneering engineer is remembered for a number of her accomplishments.
This is a real woman who's a groundbreaker, and this is a groundbreaking machine.
And the human race could use some rebalancing with a heavy dose of feminine power. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
When I was a little girl, I wished I was a boy. I tagged along behind the gang and wore my corduroys. Everybody said I only did it to annoy, but I was gonna be an engineer. Mama told me, can't you?
There's a new machine being used in New York to bore a tunnel across the Hudson River. Assembled, the tunnel boring machine measures more than 470 feet long and weighs upwards of 2.7 million pounds. And after the New York City Department of Environmental Protection, which manages New York City's water supply, held a naming contest for the machine, the choice was Nora, for the first woman in the U.S. to earn a civil engineering degree. Nora Stanton Blatch DeForest Barney earned her degree in 1905 from Cornell University and worked for the predecessor to the DEP. The DEP is using the machine for its largest repair project ever, a billion-dollar project to address two leaks in the 85-mile Delaware Aqueduct, the longest tunnel in the world, by constructing a bypass tunnel. Colleen Jenkins is Nora's granddaughter.
This is a real woman who's a groundbreaker, and this is a groundbreaking machine. And so it was a very easy choice to make. I think somebody proposed Superwoman. But, you know, I think that I'm a little tired of generic, fictitious women. Real women exist.
From 1906 to 1908, Nora worked as a draftsman for the New York City Board of Water Supply as it developed the first parts of the Catskill Water Supply System. She was paid $1,200 per year for her work, the highest salary of any draftsman on the project, and all the others fulfilling that job were men. Jenkins, who was speaking at a DEP press conference that announced the project and machine named for Nora, says Nora the human also is a suffragist and granddaughter of Elizabeth Cady Stanton, a leader in the women's rights movement.
And I'm going to end with a suffrage saying, and it is forward into the light. And what I want to do is adapt it to today for tunneling. Forward into the light at the end of the tunnel.
I caught up with Jenkins after the press conference.
So my greatest hope is that your program will be a reality, that since we are a representative democracy, that what we see around us should represent the people, we the people. And I'm involved with a government body. When I entered it, it was 25% women, 75% men. And now it's 50-50. I always support merit over gender. But you know what? There's a lot of women that have merit. And so it's time to that they recognize it for themselves, but the people around them give them opportunity to be on equal footing with men.
What government body?
I'm in the legislative body of Greenwich, Connecticut.
Elizabeth Jenkins Saleen is Colleen Jenkins' daughter. She's also the great-granddaughter of Nora and the great-great-great-granddaughter of Elizabeth Cady Stanton. She speaks to the importance of recognizing in 2017 the 100th anniversary of women's suffrage in New York State.
The attention is good because the Voting Rights Act is actively being threatened. So while we've made a lot of progress over the years, women have obviously gained the right to vote and other groups as well, that Voting Rights Act is being chipped away at, which is making it more difficult for various groups, including people of color, to access the polls and to ensure that their voices are heard. So I think as we look backwards and think about the work that's been done, we always need to look forward at the work that's left to be done. And the anniversary is, of course, an invitation to reflect on what this has meant for us and how much we value the right to vote and how much we're willing to fight for it to protect everybody's right to vote, not just women's.
Given your lineage, did you ever feel pressure?
Sure. Not directly from family, but I recognize I have large shoes to fill. And I'm often asked, what does it feel like to be the great-great-great-granddaughter of Elizabeth Cady Stanton? And I don't know that I have an answer to that question, because I don't know what it's like to not be the great-great-great-granddaughter of Elizabeth Cady Stanton. So what I will say is I do feel a sense of responsibility to protect and to preserve that history, to continue to tell those stories, a moral obligation to continue to fight for human rights with great awareness of women's rights and other communities that are still treated as second-class citizens. And so there's a sense of the work that's been done, an appreciation for that, but also an eye to the future and a recognition that we probably never will have arrived at a place of true equality, but the more we can focus on the inherent dignity and worth of every person, the closer we'll get to the end goal.
I also just want to tell you, say great, 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 got three in there, right?
Yeah.
Granddaughter. I mean, I wouldn't know who my great, great, great grandmother is. Do you have a sense, and is it solely from history books? Is it from...
It's a great point. So I grew up knowing this history in part because it's a direct descent of matrilineal descent. So my great-great-great, three greats, grandmother, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, had a daughter named Nora, who had a daughter named Harriet, who had a daughter named Rhoda, who had a daughter named Colleen, who had me. And so the fact that it's matrilineal descent, I think, really helps me to feel connected to that history. And I, of course, grew up with my grandmother and my mother telling me stories of the women who had come before us. And my mom's been great about bringing me along to all sorts of different events ever since I was a child, whether it be the moving of the statue of Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Lucretia Mott, and Susan B. Anthony from the crypt of the Capitol, the U.S. Capitol, to the Rotunda, or celebrating the 90th anniversary of the 1848 convention in Seneca Falls, New York, to here we are with a drilling machine in honor of Nora, providing fresh water, clean water to New York City. I mean, there's just been an incredible number of opportunities to lift up the history, to appreciate the accomplishments of other women, and for that I'm very grateful.
As mentioned, Nora Stanton Blatch DeForest Barney was the first woman in the U.S. to earn a civil engineering degree and did so from Cornell University. John Abel is emeritus professor of civil and environmental engineering at Cornell University and former director of the School of Civil and Environmental Engineering. As far as civil engineering, what about women? What is the percentage, and how has that changed over the years since 1905?
Well, it's changed very significantly since 1905, but most of the change has come since the 1970s. I've been the historian of civil engineering department at Cornell because it was one of the original departments, and when Cornell was celebrating its sesquicentennial 150th anniversary in 2015, I was doing research on how the department developed. As far as I know, we had only three women graduate before World War II. And Nora was the first, the next one was in 1920, and the next one was in the 1930s. And then even when I was an undergraduate at Cornell in the 1950s, there was one woman in our class, and none in the class before, none in the class after. So all that long period of less than 1% of women in engineering. I think things started to change in the 1970s, and that has changed quite rapidly recently at Cornell. And our College of Engineering and the School of Civil and Environmental Engineering have both been rather aggressive about trying to recruit women. And as of this year, the incoming class of engineers at Cornell is 50% women. And those women affiliate with different departments, but civil and environmental engineering is one of the favorite departments. Biomedical engineering, chemical engineering are the places, and also operations, research, and information engineering is another place where many women affiliate. the percentages of women going into electrical, mechanical, engineering, physics are a little bit lower, but they're making progress too. I can't tell you.
Okay. And why do you think this is? Why the?
Well, there are a lot of theories about that. I think one of the theories floating is the fields that are a little bit more physics-based are somehow less appealing, and those that are environmentally or biologically or medically significant. But it's true that even in mechanical engineering, they're doing a lot of biologically related things like joint emplacements and so forth, that designing the devices that replace a knee or a hip or so forth. So I think that's helping to bring more women in. Where we still have progress needed is hiring more women faculty. And that is, I think, a pipeline problem, is that we need to get more women to go on to graduate degrees and do research and become interested in education. But we have many of our undergraduate women over the past couple decades have gone into significant jobs, not just in office design, sitting in an office designing facilities and infrastructure, but also working in the construction field in terms of management and so forth. And that's a real challenge, because there you're in a very close intersection with the construction workers, and they're a notoriously macho group of people, right? And so it takes real guts to work closely with them, but I think we're seeing evidence that they're gaining the respect of the workers as well as their professional colleagues.
And of Nora, and why we're here today and able to have these conversations, I just wanted you to speak to her being the first woman to be granted a degree from Cornell for civil engineering. Clearly groundbreaking, but then, as you said, there were many years between the next one and then the next one. And so just wanted you to speak to that and the naming of a machine in engineering for her.
Well, sure. Nora was groundbreaking, I think, because she came from a tradition of great strength in the women's movement, with her grandmother being Elizabeth Cady Stanton. And I think there were a lot of challenges to being an undergraduate at that time, because people viewed engineering as being a male field. And she did research as an undergraduate that received national notice, that she published some of that research. And she's noted in the history of hydraulic engineering in the U.S. At least a little more than a footnote, but at least a mention. And then she became the first female member of the American Society of Civil Engineers, which is the national professional organization.
But well after the fact.
She was joined just as soon as she graduated as a junior member. And one of the stories of the difficulty at that time is that after a certain number of years as being a junior member, you need to apply to be promoted to the next highest level, which she did in, I think, around 1915, with a very nice resume of all of her engineering work and letters of recommendation from Cornell professor that she had done research with and so forth. And the ASCE, the Civil Engineering Society, decided not to allow her to advance and essentially to terminate her membership. She actually took this case to the New York State courts, and the courts denied her petition because they felt that it was a private organization, they had no jurisdiction. And so essentially she dropped out of the association because of this denial. And it's something that came up as we were doing the history again of the civil engineering at Cornell, and turned out that thanks to one of our alums who read the note in the newsletter about her history with the ASCE, realized what an injustice this was. He's a professor at the University of Kansas. His name is David Darwin, And he called up his friend, who was the president of ASCE at that time, and they immediately realized that they had made a tremendous mistake, and including, though, the fact that all along they've been citing Nora as the first woman member of ASCE, even though they had terminated her membership. And so they passed a wonderful resolution about inclusiveness and at the same time advanced Nora to the grade of fellow, which is the highest grade of membership in the ASCE. And excuse me?
What year?
2015. And so they had a big ceremony and had descendants of Nora there to receive this membership. And we also marked it in our engineering celebration of the sesquicentennial, excuse me. We've erected a plaque in our civil engineering building honoring Nora and her legacy, but also pointing out how this wrong had been righted. So,
Nora Stanton Blatch DeForest Barney died in 1971 at the age of 87. To feel into the wound and healing of the soul of America is an expression of feminine power. This human principle exists inside women, men, and all genders and has the potential to rebalance our species and lead the world forward. That's according to producer Ari Golden, who says human survival depends on it. For 51%, here's her piece entitled, On the Great Rebalancing.
Listen, close, connect, relate to change taking place in the United States through the lens of a mother.
What can I do to help?
We're living in a time of imbalance.
What do I have to give?
The word apocalypse is a Greek word meaning the lifting of the veil.
Nobody sees the man behind the curtain. Don't look at the man behind the curtain. I am the great and powerful Oz.
And so as the veil is lifted, we see things as they are.
There is a dying process that will have to happen.
Feel into a wound in the soul of humanity.
Feel into the wound of the soul of humanity.
Particularly in America, because America's been so built up on this sort of puppetry and fraudulent sense of the image of success and the image of power and the image of fame and, you know, all these ways that America's been caught in this, you know, perpetual adolescent cycle of narcissistic self-adoration that's really based in deep insecurity.
Be with the pain until it moves all the way through, dissolving a top-down model of win and lose.
Win-lose is defined, so it's like you know exactly where you fall. Win-win is full of possibility and travel.
Choose to work together laterally and weave.
You're seeing a rise in feminine power, and we need it.
Feminine power over time has expanded itself.
Circular and cyclical and interesting and full and potent.
Feminine power is the power of knowing.
Knowing.
How to bring our powers together to a greater power.
Having a clear vision, but really valuing other people's opinions into that vision.
It feels tribal.
That's what I love about power, if you think about it. It feels like it's a finite thing, but it's not. And the minute you share it, it expands.
Open to how much we are all of it inside of ourselves.
Masculine, feminine inside ourselves.
Draw the two energies together, balancing any polarity.
Each principle holds wisdom.
That's when we can all really be our true selves and get real and connect to every part of who we are.
I think that's what this new era of leadership is about. And I think what this new era of feminism is about.
A new wave is is emerging with critical questions surging.
What is our part to take responsibility for? What is our part to play? We have power, how will we use it? We have gifts, how will we give them? And that's for each, the America inside of each one of us, inside of each little conversation.
Feel into the wound of the soul of America.
Talking about power and choice and responsibility, about anger, about, you know, the power to love ourselves, the power to choose.
Choose wisely.
Each woman has the opportunity to assess for herself what she wants. Some women will choose never to have children. That's never been a choice. And so here we are as modern women, we can define that.
There's these old, old archetypes of what is a feminine receiving archetype and then the powerful male archetype, and or masculine. I guess maybe that's the distinction. It's like there are these feminine and masculine energies, but like why do they have to be in a female or a male body?
Because we make life. I think at the core of so much of this is that reproduction.
Birth, life, gentleness, creativity. I mean, creation, that's the essence of it right there, isn't it?
Raise this generation, tend the hearts of our future citizens.
Gratitude.
Oh, you're so delicious.
Presence.
Oh, I got little lips.
Children give time a face. I love you, baby. When you really show up for it, you learn to love more fiercely than you ever thought possible.
It's being able to receive and see others.
America needs to grow up, mature, be humbled, and ask itself, you know, what is our part?
I think it ties to my deep concern and compassion for all women on the planet now, in the past, in the future, and how all of you have been treated and are being treated today, currently. It's not just a tragedy. It is so far beyond speakable that it's overwhelming as a man, because I know so many of us are the deeper cause of so much of that suffering. So I have this intense desire to do something about it as a man. Like, I'm a fixer, like, oh, something's wrong, let's fix it. And I'm have to do something. And I've learned over the last 10 years or so that actually one of the most powerful things I can do is just sit in it with somebody and be there, just be present. I don't actually have to do anything more than that. That often is doing exactly what needs to be done. So figuring out how to sit in it, be present, and listen, and just connect, feel.
What happens when a person becomes a parent, both a mother and a father, is that they become more whole. So if there were parts of themselves, like their masculine side that was undeveloped, they're forced to develop that part. If their feminine side was underdeveloped, they're forced to develop that part. How emotionally intelligent are you? How brave are you with your heart? I think we need each other. We need to be in balance in order to create a really effective system that works. Our future depends on it. Our planet depends on it.
Listen close, connect, relate to change taking place in the United States through the lens of a mother.
On The Great Rebalancing is part of the series A Mother's Lens, which was created by producer Ari Golden. You can find more of her work at arigolden.com. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1475.